Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, there's an awful lot going on in the news at the moment, but we've got a guest today, and we've got a guest that I'm really excited about. So David Collins, Sunday Times reporter. David is the youngest reporter to win the News Reporter of the Year, the Press Awards for helping police convict Levi Belfield for the murder of Millie Dowler. He brings massive experience with him. And in fact, Nazir, you know him.
Very much so. Yeah. He's also very recently won the Poor Foot Investigator of the Year Award in relation to the matter that we're going to, matters that we've discussed previously. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I first came into contact with him in relation to the matter that ultimately led to the substance of his book, which is called The Silver Killers, and which we'll discuss shortly. But, you know, David, he's a Northern editor. I live in the North. So on a regular occasions, he would want me to perhaps comment on a crime justice story. And I'm always happy to do so because he tends to report what I said rather than twist it and turn it. But in any event, I think it's important that we have a conversation about the Silver Killers, David, simply because it's not a whodunit, because on the face of it, the police know whodunit. They say it was the men in those particular homes. But of course, your book and subsequent investigation suggests something different. Tell us a little bit about where this came from and what we are talking about.
Sure. Hi, guys. And thanks for having me on, both of you. It's a pleasure to be on this brilliant podcast with you both. So the way it kind of it came about was it was in April 2020, and it was the kind of height of lockdown when we're all kind of working from home and from our garden sheds and, you know, living rooms and what have you, because we couldn't go into the office. I basically got a call. It was from a kind of trusted source, a trusted contact who was kind of plugged in, connected to Cheshire Police. And that person was in possession of a confidential report that had been written by the senior coroner's officer for Cheshire Police, called Stephanie Davis. And Stephanie had found in this kind of, well, she did a review basically of two murder suicides that happened in Wilmslow in 1996 and 1999. And in both the cases, the husbands had been blamed for murdering their wife, and then killing themselves. So that was the same in both those cases in that town in the 90s. And what she'd done is she'd gone back over the evidence, because the coroner's office had never been entirely happy with the police's determination on both those cases. So she'd done a review, and she'd come to the conclusion that they were not murder suicides, that they're the work of a single offender who had not yet been caught. And basically, I remember receiving it. It was 180 pages, and I read it in one sitting. And as you guys know, Mark, being a former police officer and a journalist, and Nazir, used to doing the CPS, you know, you get a report like that, and it kind of, some things just kind of, you can't get let go of. You kind of snag your attention, and because the findings were just so extraordinary.
So basically, what we had was somebody in the coroner's office now saying that there was potentially a serial killer out there.
That's right. That's exactly right.
What's happened with that, David? Where is that? Is this someone still at large then?
So what happened was Stephanie had submitted that report twice. So she submitted it the first time in 2018, and then she submitted it a second time in 2020. And the 2020 report, the gap in between, she used to basically go to independent forensic experts and kind of former experienced kind of SIOs and detectives to basically verify her findings and just to see what they thought as a second opinions. There were two really renowned forensic experts who came back and corroborated what she said. They found it far more likely on on the evidence that they saw, that those murder-suicides were actually not murder-suicides. For a number of reasons. And so on the second time she submitted that report, the police did look at it. They did a review. They refused to open up the cases, however, so they never became cold case reviews. It became basically a paper exercise where they looked at the report, they looked at the, compared it to the original findings, and then Cheshire Police said they're happy, basically, they're not going to open up the case, but they were happy to keep an open mind if any future evidence came in.
Let's go back to the beginning, David. So I've seen the photographs of both couples in bed having shot themselves. Let's go right back to the very beginning. So set the scene. We've got the first couple. They're an elderly couple. They are found, gunshot wounds, pretty horrible, in the bed. And I think actually there is there's a suffocation that takes place as well. Just talk to us. Not too much detail, because obviously the people are listening to this, but give us a sense of what took place.
Sure. So in the first case, that's the 1996 case in Wilmslow, that's Howard and Bea Ainsworth. So Howard and Bea, just to kind of set the scene, were an elderly couple. They were kind of happily married, as far as anybody knew. They'd been married for more than 50 years. They spent all their time together. They had no health issues, no significant health issues. They had no financial worries. They had strong family support. There were no kind of trigger events in their lives to suggest what was basically about to happen.
No health issues?
No health issues, no finance issues, no family, serious family concerns. So it really was completely out of the blue. And what happened is the neighbour, Margaret Farrar, she noticed one Sunday morning, that the curtains were still drawn and it was unusual for them. So she called the police. Two uniformed officers attended the scene. Went into the house by the back kitchen door, which was open, and went upstairs. Margaret stayed downstairs. The two officers sort of walked up the stairs into the hallway, into the main bedroom, where they saw the most horrific sight, that never left them, really. You had Howard was on, if you're standing at the foot of the bed, looking up at the headboard, Howard is on the left, B is on the right. B has a kitchen knife impaled into her forehead. She has multiple wounds to her head, which have come from a hammer. She has bruises around her body. And on the left-hand side, where you have Howard, Howard is lying there. He has a bag over his head. And there's some interesting injuries that Howard also has. He's got bruising to his mouth and to his lips as well, which were never explained by the pathologist. That's the scene that they found walking in. And in terms of weapons that they found, if you like, they found a hammer that was in the bedroom on a side cabinet. They found a hammer in the bathroom sink, and they found a ligature beside the bed. They found a bottle of pills beside Howard, a bottle of tablets, and they found a note. They found a suicide note, which was purportedly written by Howard. So that's the scene that the officers found, and that's kind of what begins the investigation. Local CID come down and kind of do an initial kind of surveying of the scene, if you like.
Just based on what you've described, I mean, that's not any murder-suicide that I've come across. I mean, it seems extraordinary amount of violence. You know, the idea that you have a loving relationship which ends with a knife in the head. I mean, I just can't picture that. And I can see why the coroner was concerned about whether or not that was an outside party rather than one of those two.
And it's an interesting one. And a lot of kind of police officers I went to and spoke to about this. And I think you know, I went to you, didn't I, Nadir, for advice, you know, initially. And a lot of people pick out that the extremity of violence, and, you know, we'll talk about the second case as well in a minute, but it shows the same really, really high level of violence that has come completely out of the blue. There's no suggestion of this about to happen. And I know, you know, there's always the argument we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. We have to accept that in any relationship, you don't know the full 100% truth about the state of that relationship. That is true. But there are things inside that house which I feel, and the coroner's officers felt, didn't stack up. You know, one of the things is you have a note, a suicide note, that describes how he has killed his wife in the past tense, and yet it doesn't bear any relation to what's happened. You know, he says he's given her pills and throttled her because their lives have gone, and he basically describes in this note the idea that their lives have ended, basically, and it's all because she has a tummy bug. A lot of kind of the rationale, if you like, for this suicide letter uses is the fact that their lives have ended because B has is ill.
The suicide letter presumably was analysed and identified as being his handwriting. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the police came back and said it looks like it's his handwriting. That's right. So I guess, you know, in that scenario, you'd have, well,
secure premises, forced entry in any manner?
No. So the back door was left. It was unlocked, and there's no sign. There's no sign of forced entry into the house.
So if it is a third party, they've gained entry to the house via insecurity. They've caused horrific injuries and murdered two people, and then left anything stolen?
Not as far as they know. Not as far as they're aware. So family members went into the house afterwards and had a look around the house, and they didn't see anything that had kind of gone, that had been obvious, that had gone missing. But I don't think they had much. I mean, this was a kind of, they were an elderly couple who were really affluent kind of part of Wilmslow. You know, now the house that they're in would be worth kind of, you know, a lot of money, 700,000, I'd imagine. But they weren't the sort of couple that have a lot of kind of money or cash or jewellery lying around the house.
The anomalies in relation to it being a third party and a murder is very much sitting around the brutality, the violence that's used, the non-consistency between the suicide letter and the actual injuries that occurred themselves. Would that be right?
I'd say that's right. And also, there's a big one for me in that there's a bottle of pills that are beside Howard's bed on the bedside cabinet, and that it's a prescription only drug called Hemeverin. Which is typically used for, it can be used in older people who are kind of, to sedate them. It can be used as a kind of, for people who are addicted to alcohol, to help them with that. But it is prescription only, and it's never been explained how that bottle of tablets arrived at the scene. How are they there?
So they're not prescription to either party?
On the label, on the tab, on the bottle.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, basically, who they've been prescribed to.
And was there a medical analysis? I mean, GPs presumably were asked by doctors. Were they on prescription?
So that's another interesting point. So they did go to the GP practice and ask them, was B or Howard's, did they have a prescription for these drugs? The answer was no. They didn't have them on prescription. And they did an analysis in the toxicology. They did an analysis of both of them. And particularly in Howard's case...
I'm just concerned, David, that the Samaritans have told us never to articulate means and methods of suicide. So I think we shouldn't go into any more detail.
But basically, what they found in the toxicology was that Howard hadn't taken any tablets, despite them being beside his bedside table.
And what about the murder weapons, the hammers and the knife, from the property or externally brought in?
So they're not sure on that, where the weapon, I don't think they ever got to the bottom of where the hammers or the knife came from. The problem was, I mean, part of the problem was, which is detailed in the book, and it's something that Christine Hurst, one of the coroner's officers, came up against. When she saw the photographs of the crime scene, she saw that, and a big one for her as well, was when the post-mortem came back, the pathology came back, the proposed method that the police were saying, it's murder-suicide, how it did it. He couldn't explain the injuries to his face. And the pathologist says that in his post-mortem report. And he makes clear, it's not known how he has all these bruises to his lips. That is not known. What Christine thought straight away was that it has far more in common with a hand being clamped over the mouth and the person being suffocated. What she also thought was that the body had been propped up in the bed, his hand is trapped underneath him in a really awkward position, almost like somebody had lifted him and put him down. Combined with, the injuries to his mouth, where the tablets come from, the extremity of the violence, the absolutely out of the blue nature of it,
So let's look at it. If a third party gains entrance to the house to kill them, why? The brutality involved in the crimes, and I've seen the crime scene photographs, the brutality involved in these acts is brutal, and I've seen many, many murder victims. But for a stranger to come into the house, unless there is something really specifically wrong to them, that does seem to be an extraordinary violence that seems to be inflicted upon them. Is there any reason for that? I mean, what would be the benefit of the killer? What are they looking to obtain from it?
There's a number of possible things in terms of the killer's motive. It could be an act of just the simple act of violence in itself. I guess potentially, the act of the murder itself is something that the killer psychologically wants to do, needs to do. That is one.
Straightforward sadism, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's, yeah, I mean, I think, I've certainly seen that, several times in my career. Certainly with Levi Belfield, that was his motive. I mean, he would just go up to young women with a hammer and smash them to death. It was a simple psychological need to inflict pain.
Breaking into a house, though, is a little bit different, to go into a house and actually cause that brutality. But let's hold that thought there. So that case gets basically closed down, murder-suicide by the police. And then there's another set of killings.
So then the second one that we see occurs around the corner in Wilmslow. That's in 1999. That's 3 years later. So what we have there is pretty much a carbon copy. So it's an elderly couple, middle class, very well-to-do. They're called Donald Ward and Oriel Ward. And Donald is a retired chemist. Oriel's a retired nursery teacher. They are very wealthy. They have a large kind of house, dormer bungalow in Wilmslow. They have lots of kind of land around it. They have a large estate, So in this case, again, a neighbour goes in, goes up to the bedroom, and as you're standing at the foot of the bed, in exactly the same way, the husband, Donald, is on the left, Oriel is on the right. Oriel has been stabbed more than a dozen times in the neck. She's been hit around the head. She's got severe blunt force trauma around the head, bruising. He is covered in stab wounds. He's got stab wounds to his groin. He's got stab wounds to his wrists. He's got cuts to his hands, to his palm. He's got a large knife, a cut across his neck, and he's got a knife impaled in his heart. So again, really extreme violence. And once again, the police found absolutely no motive, nothing to suggest that this might have happened, that this was about to happen. What is interesting about that crime scene as well is it matches the first one in a lot of different ways. You know, you have the bodies arranged in a specific way. You have both the women, interestingly, have their night dresses lifted up to expose their pubic area. They're both a match for each other. You have the same level of violence used, the same weaponry.
So knife and hammer used?
There is evidence of Oriel being hit with a hammer. She has a puncture wound on the head. And she has a dozen stab wounds to the neck, if you like. So really extreme violence. The thing about this case, they are different in some ways. You know, not just the way the crime scenes are arranged. But one thing that is quite interesting about this case is the way that Donald is said to have killed himself by the police. So for the police to be right, which may be possible, I mean, it is possible. And I can see in this case, you know, they did a much better job. They worked much harder on this case. They were looking for a killer or potential killers for months. And this is after, you know, the pathology, the crime scene reports, the experts go in. They still believe for a long time that there was a murderer that they needed to catch. Part of that was because of the defence wounds that were found on Donald's hands, which they felt like indicated he was being attacked by somebody with a knife, and Donald was trying to protect himself.
Did they link these two together? Did they connect them in any way? Did they think there's some similarities between the two cases, or were they dealt with as total isolation?
From what I can see, in terms of the kind of the SIO reports and the police investigation kind of notes, and the police officers I spoke to, was that they were treated in isolation. The first case, the Ainsworths, was considered in passing, but only as a murder-suicide. So the SIO, the senior detective on the Ward's case, he did bring it into his report at the inquest, because he said that he was trying to think of a way, basically, that why has Donald, you know, done this, and why there's a similarity as well in that his door is also unlocked on his house, just the same as it is with the Ainsworths. There is a door that is left unlocked.
And do we know roughly what time both of these things occurred? Was there any indication given in time? Was it overnight? Was it in the early hours of the morning?
It's not clear on the Ainsworth case, but it's likely to be late evening, early hours of the morning. And with the Wards, it is more than likely it's around about 6 o'clock in the morning, potentially a bit earlier than that on a Tuesday. They know that because an alarm has been deactivated, they think, unless it was deactivated the night before. But they think it was the early hours of Tuesday morning, so kind of both early hours of the morning.
David, I mean, amazing cases, and we don't want to give too much away, because I think it's important that people, you know, and we can give some good detail in a minute in terms of the book so that people can go and read it. But let's come to an end of that in a minute. There's some other things I want to talk to you about. But let's talk in terms of where this case is now. So we've obviously got the coroner's officer. She did a report, and I think that got into the newspapers, and she got into a lot of trouble for it. What's happened with that?
So after we reported on the story, and they opened up, they looked at the review that Stephanie, the senior coroner's officer for Cheshire Police, had written. So they read it, and they refused to open up the cases for a cold case review. And now, I've never been a police officer, but I understand how police officers think and work, because I know a lot of them. And what they've told me is they can understand that decision, although it is frustrating, because I think there is probably enough there, but there is no smoking gun. You know, there's no absolutely nailed on kind of suspicious behaviour in terms of, you know, a new sighting, a new witness. It's a lot of pieces of a jigsaw that have been put together.
Didn't Stephanie link to a third in Greater Manchester?
That's right. So as part of that review, that report, she looked at other cases because, you know, she was so convinced that a single offender was responsible for both. She looked for a wider pattern. And this is an interesting point, I think, because as part of that, she did research and she looked at murder-suicides of elderly couples. So she looked at married elderly couples who had been involved in murder-suicides in the UK between 2000 and 2019. So she looked at that kind of 19-year period. And there were only 39 in the country. If you then input into that 39 sharp and blunt force trauma, which is what these Wilmslow cases involved, you narrow it down to 3 cases in the entire country across 19 years. And they're all in the northwest. There was one up the road in Didsbury, which occurred the year after the Wards case. There was another one in Manchester, a fourth one. There was a fifth one as well in Cumbria, which I do cover in my book. I'm less convinced by the fourth and fifth, but I think the third case, the Higgins, Michael and Violet Higgins, that is quite compelling. The family are completely convinced that Michael is innocent. One of the reasons was he had advanced Parkinson's disease. So I've spoken to lots of people who knew him, and he described him as extremely frail. He could barely make and hold a cup of tea. That's how it's been described to me. He shook a lot. He had no dexterity left. This is a man who the police apparently said, you know, brutally murdered his wife and then killed himself. It shows to do that does require a certain level of physical ability. And I think there are question marks over whether he was capable of doing that, just his basic dexterity.
So David, what do you think? So we've got a situation where we've got certainly two that have been directly linked together, a third in Manchester being linked by effectively profiling. So either there is a serial killer out there who enters people's houses through an insecurity, brutally attacks them, stages it in some way potentially to look like a murder-suicide, has a number of years, 3 years between first and the second offence. I'm not sure the date of the third one. Is there a serial killer on the loose around the north of England, or is this just as it has been put down by the police, murder-suicide?
I think on the balance, after looking at these cases for a while, I'm convinced by the Wilmslow cases. I'm not sure on the third one. I think there is good medical evidence from the family about Michael to protest his innocence. But we never got the case files for that, for the third one. So I don't know as much as the police know about that one. But certainly, I know a lot about the first two. I know a lot in terms of what the police had in terms of evidence. I know that there were big gaps in their investigation in terms of especially the first one. You know, they didn't do the correct forensic or fingerprinting tests that the coroner's officer asked for, because the murder weapons and the bag on Howard's head had been handled so many times that when the coroner's officer said the coroner will want these to be tested and they will want that to form part of the inquest, the response back from the police was, we're really sorry, effectively. They've been handled so many times at that crime scene.
In a nutshell, David, in a nutshell, are you saying, based on your research, there was, it may not still be alive, but there was a serial killer operating in Cheshire in the late 90s?
I'd say on the balance, with the first two cases, the same person is responsible for those, yes, and that a serial killer wasn't caught by the police.
Right.
And that they went for the easiest
explanation,
the easiest conclusion, the simplest conclusion. You had tunnel vision in the first one. They decided in days what had happened. They decided before the post-mortem had even been carried out, they decided that Howard was the killer. They cleaned up the house before the post-mortem was carried out on those two. So I think the first one, the investigation wasn't thrown off. The second one, they did believe there was a killer for a long time. But from what I was told by an insider on that investigation, he told me that budget and resources are finite at Cheshire Police at that time. There was a lot of cases coming in. It was the Ward's case was set up as a big murder inquiry. People wanted the bodies. They wanted the resource back. And at the point where they drew the line in the sand, it's not necessarily that the police didn't believe it was Donald Ward responsible. You know, there's no suggestion of a cover-up in those terms. But what that police officer told me was at the point where they drew the line in the sand, they felt like Donald was the most likely killer. And he was presented to the family, to the public, to the coroner as the murderer of his wife. But as you both know, and you know, Hamish Campbell told me this once. He was once, you know, the Met's most senior detective. He said the absence of proof is not necessarily proof in itself, and you can draw too much from negatives. And the issue with the second one, the Wards, and possibly the first, was that it wasn't obvious. The third party wasn't obvious. You know, there was no, you know, this person was clever. And although there was work to find a third party in the second case, what ultimately ruled a third party out and made Donald the most likely is because there was no nailed-on forensics for them to point at and say this person was in a house at a certain time.
David, it throws up so many questions for me, and I I'm going to get your book and I'm going to read it because, you know, for me, I asked the question, you know, why 3 years in between? Have there been any murders similar to this since the second one that's definitely linked? Why would somebody do this? What's the likelihood of someone becoming an offender in this way? And actually, sometimes when it, you know, when it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it is a duck rather than looking for a different option. But let's just hold that, and we're going to promote the book really heavily very shortly. But I just want to talk a little bit about how important journalism is in the overall scheme of policing and the criminal justice system. And I know you had a really crucial role in relation to Levi Belfield. In summary, just give us what your role was in that.
So with Levi, so that was when I was a training reporter, I was 26, and I spent a lot of time basically working on the Billy Dowler murder case. That was probably one of the biggest murder cases this country's ever seen, as you know. As a former Surrey police officer, aren't you?
I am, yeah, my 4-7.
So you know all about the Millie case. So at the time, it was an unsolved murder, but he had a prime suspect who was Levi Belfield. He was in prison at the time for the murder of two women, Amelie Delagrange and Marsha McDonnell. He was caught for that by Colin Sutton, the brilliant detective for the Met. So he was in prison at the time. The investigation by Surrey Police was focusing on Belfield as being the killer, but they hadn't proven it conclusively yet. They hadn't, you know, charged him for it. So that's when I got involved. I got involved through somebody in Levi Belfield's circle who I got to know, and I kind of started working my way into Belfield's circle because Belfield knew I was a journalist and he knew I wanted to interview him. He is an extremely kind of attention-seeking person, and describe him as, you know, he's a complete psychopath. His emotional kind of understanding of the world is so own tunnel vision towards himself. He wants a platform at all times. You know, he wants attention. We can see it in the last few years. You know, the stuff that he's linking himself to the Chittenden murders. And
So what did you do, David? In relation to Levi, what did you do to... what was your kind of involvement in that?
So I spent about 6 months getting to know his circle, his family, his friends, until they were in a position where they were comfortable enough that I could interview Belfield. I couldn't get into Wakefield Prison, so we set up a series of interviews, calls made through his brother's house. So Belfield, what he'd do, he'd ring at the same time every single day, would chat with the family, and he'd just call up from his prison in Wakefield. And I remember sitting there over Sunday dinner, and the phone rang, and his mum, Jean, who's now dead, answered the phone. And she was having a conversation about EastEnders. And she finished the conversation and said, "All right, Lee, all right, speak to you tomorrow." Hung up the phone. And I said to her, "Was that Levi Belfield?" And she said, "Yeah." And naively, at the time, I didn't realise how easy it was, you know, for prisoners to call the outside world and have these conversations. And I remember thinking, well, that's the way, that's how we interview, I'll come back tomorrow. And that's how it kind of happened.
What did the prison think of that? What did the Ministry of Justice think of that? Because there are some very clear rules in terms of being able to have access and interview prisoners.
There are. So basically, we looked at the route of kind of going down, asking the governor and getting the governor to sign off for the Ministry of Justice, but it would have never happened.
No.
It would have been a flat refusal, because I have never, ever known a journalist to get access to a really high-profile offender in the last, you know, 10 years. I've just never really known it.
No.
20 years, even.
But that didn't cause any criticism. Didn't cause any problems. You got an interview and it was all okay.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we did was we just so the brother answered the phone and passed me the phone and I did the interview. So it wasn't, we didn't have the permission of the MOJ. There was no way they would have given us it.
No.
I did two interviews with him, and on the second interview. The second interview was about Millie. The first one was kind of getting him kind of comfortable. He wanted to use me as a platform to protest his innocence, to say I didn't kill Emily, I didn't kill Marcia. I was fitted up by the police. The CCTV evidence is wrong. The mobile phone evidence is wrong. This is why, you know, he convinced his whole family that he'd never done anything wrong in his entire life. The second interview was about Millie. I made it about Millie. I kind of imposed myself a bit more on him because he is really controlling as a character. He's so controlling. He has this interesting conversational, I don't know what you call it, tick, where after he says a sentence, he says, "Are you with me? Are you with me?" He says that all the time.
Right.
It always stuck in my head, that, because it's almost like you don't know whether to answer it or not, but it's like a kind of... He's trying to control you, and you can see it in his personality. And the crucial thing he gave away in the second interview, I mean, he talked a lot about his whereabouts, where he was, what he was doing that day, who he was with, the vehicles he was driving, the fact that he'd given up his car and swapped it at the time, so he didn't have access to his usual van. He'd given it to his mate, but he was doing DIY at the time, and he was buying stuff in Shepparton. So he had his girlfriend at the time, Emma Mills, his Red Daewoo car. So this is the Red Daewoo car that was caught on CCTV. So at the time, Surrey police put out a CCTV of the Red Daewoo car. So they suspected, basically, they knew the registration plate. They knew it was probably Emma Mills. Well, they knew it was Emma Mills' girlfriend's car. What they didn't know and didn't have was that he was driving it that day. The CCTV was caught on Station Avenue, pulling out onto that road half an hour after Millie Dowler was last seen on that same road. So the reason it was so important to the police was that he admitted to me he was driving it, he had the keys for it, but it wasn't Millie in the boot that day. It was, he had DIY goods in the car that day.
So you were able to then pass that information on to the police?
So afterwards, because I knew basically he'd implicated himself, a serial killer had put himself on the murder scene at the same time as the disappearance of a 13-year-old, I knew how compelling that would be for a jury, for the police, and whatever. So yeah, we cooperated with the police. And it's an interesting one because we've got a case at the moment, actually, where we're investigating the murder of a Kenyan woman called Agnes Wanjiru, who was murdered by a British soldier. We've got kind of been working on that for a long time and got a lot of new evidence, basically solved the case inside of 2 months. I mean, it wasn't particularly hard. Everybody in that regiment knows who did it, which is why it's so flabbergasting. It's taken the Royal Military Police 10 years to get anywhere on it. You know, we did it in 2 months. But I think that's another case where it's kind of, because journalists have to be very careful with what they hand over to the police.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, obviously, source protection is, you know, I would go to jail. And you can't be a journalist unless you're prepared to go to jail for a source or a contact to protect that person. Because if you're not prepared to do that, you have absolutely no credibility. But if you have evidence, and it's a case-by-case basis for me, if you do have evidence that can help the police and the authorities, and it doesn't affect a confidential source, and in that case, I mean, Belfield's not a confidential source. You know, he's a serial killer. I'm interviewing him openly as a journalist. And a lot of what he said went in the newspaper. So, and handing over those tapes was of benefit to Surrey Police. And I'm glad I did it because, you know, afterwards, Marie Woodall, she did say, I saw a recent documentary, actually, where she was saying that evidence took the case to a whole new level.
As journalists, we have a moral responsibility as well, don't we? You know, if we obtain evidence that can capture a killer to stop it from happening again, then I think we have a duty to do that. We obviously have to do it in a safe way. And I kind of, I suppose, I come from both sides of the fence because I come as a former detective and now as a journalist, and obviously see the value of what I can do as a journalist to help, you know, the police. David, you've given us an amazing snapshot of your career to date. Just give us a sense of what you're working on now and talk us through how people can get hold of the book.
So The Hunt for the Silver Killer is out now in Waterstones and on Amazon as hardback. It's out next year in paperback. So and it's getting good reviews, so I'd highly recommend it.
I saw a comment from Jeremy Clarkson. Did I see a comment from Jeremy?
I know.
A truly astonishing murder mystery. This is proper journalism, Jeremy Clarkson.
There you go.
Yeah, 4.6 on Amazon, David. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Same. What are you at? What are you?
4.7. I just thought I'd share.
So I always meet up with the zero and I say, "What rating is your book?" And I'm always like a tiny point behind them. At the moment, I'm working on the murder case. This story of Agnes Wanjiru and the British Army is extraordinary, and I think there will be developments this year. The case is so compelling against the British soldier. There is evidence that the regiment covered it up, that the Kenyans or the British authorities wanted it to go away because it's against the backdrop of a multi-million pound defence agreement. So there's loads of interesting kind of things going on with that. It may see, for the first ever time, a British soldier extradited. And, you know, we did if you've not seen any of that work, if you Google Agnes Wanjiru and Sunday Times, I highly recommend, you know, if you're interested in murder, kind of crime investigation mysteries, that is an extraordinary story. You know, we got to an eyewitness who the suspect, the soldier, he's basically, the story goes that he murdered Agnes. He put her into a septic tank, which is a hole in the ground, in a hotel in Kenya near the British Army base, and she died. She was actually still alive. She was stabbed and put in the septic tank and she was still alive, and he locked this kind of metal lid over her, and she died in basically in kind of effluent, people's waste. And the soldier ran into the bar, said, "Oh my God, I've done something really bad." He took 3 soldiers to that spot, opened up the septic tank, and she was dead in the hole. And we got to one of those 3 eyewitnesses who admitted the entire thing to us. you know, we have multiple sources in the regiment. Everybody in the regiment who trained to Kenny at that time knew who was responsible for that murder, which is why it's so stunning. It is an absolute kind of example of why the system in this country doesn't work in terms of investigating soldiers. We've seen it with Panorama. We've just done the war crimes Afghanistan work. We can see it in this case. In my view, the Royal Military Police is a body that is not fit for purpose. It never has been. It should not be responsible for investigating soldiers. It should be the British police or an entirely reformed body.
I think we'll probably do in the future dedicate a whole podcast to that issue, to be honest. But,
you could. Yeah. I could talk about it forever if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Royal Military Police, obviously I've had dealings with Royal Military Police from working at Guildford and Surrey, which was when I first started, very close, of course, to Aldershot and where the home of the Royal British Army was. And so I've had a lot of dealings with the Royal Military Police, and I have to say, I do concur with your views in relation to that. David, it's been a great pleasure having you on here, and certainly in terms of the work that you've done and you continue to do, and keep doing it. You know, it's people like you, it's journalists like you that you know, lift the stone and will go that extra mile to try and get justice and answer the questions that remain unanswered. So congratulations on your book. It sounds absolutely fascinating. I would encourage everybody to read it, because it clearly is a book that can provide so much information for people. Has it been quite a cathartic, exciting thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's what kind of... it's the way I'd like to kind of, you know, go in the future, really. I always wanted to be an author, and kind of, I guess it's the next step for being a journalist, isn't it? You're an author. But I like it because you can really get into the detail. You know, newspaper journalism, even the Sunday Times, you know, the longest piece in the Sunday Times would be like 5,000-6,000 words, which is big. But, you know, the book's 80,000. So you can really get into that minutiae detail, flesh out the arguments, leave no stone unturned, get it all in there. That's what I like about it. It's a complete piece of work. Well, it's as complete a piece of work as I can do it as and present it as, which is what I like about books.
Brilliant.
So, The Hunt for Silver Killer, The Shocking True Story of a Murderer Who Remains at Large by David Collins, is available on Amazon and any of your good bookshops. Brilliant. David, you're fantastic. You keep up the good work. Nazir, what a brilliant guy to have on board.
Absolutely fantastic. He didn't say we're actually working on another. We're actually working on another story, aren't we, David, but we can't talk about it just yet.
We are. We'll do a podcast on that.
Yeah,
we'll get you back on that. But Nazir, I think this is great when you've got people out there who are providing their skills to help the police. I mean, I do it all the time, but I think it's brilliant that we've got journalists out there who are doing those things, who are helping to get answers. Because so sadly, you and I know there's so many victims out there, so many families out there who just get left alone.
Obviously, the problem that policing and prosecuting have is that we have to comply with the rules. Yeah. It's not a problem. It's what we must do. What journalists can do is, not necessarily bend the rules, but undoubtedly they can go to places perhaps where police and prosecutors can't do. But more importantly, you made the bigger point: journalists hold power to account.
Yeah,
and it's absolutely key that they are supported, protected. They're not enemies of the people. They are the people. And we should, you know, like David and yourself, you know, people who've really dedicated to trying to find out the stuff that people want to hide.
We have, you know, there's a lot of criticism faced in the media over the years with Leveson things. But when it's got right, the journalisms can absolutely change people's lives, aren't they?
100%.
They can make a massive difference.
100%.
Nazir, as ever, brilliant, brilliant guest. And, you know, if you are listening to this, then please do go out and buy his book. I'll tell you the title again: The Hunt for the Silver Killer, The Shocking True Story of a Murderer Who Remains at Large. David Collins, Sunday Times author. So until a couple of weeks' time, you look after yourself, Nazir. And brilliant, brilliant podcast again.
Bye now.
Take care. Please do let us know what you think of the podcast. You can follow us on all the social media platforms. Please do also tell us about cases you particularly think are interesting and areas that we should cover. And until 2 weeks' time, look after yourself, and we'll see you then. Take care. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.